the Talking Tigers podcast, presented by the Alabama Department of Public Health. Don't wait. Vaccinate. Protect yourself and others against COVID and flu. For more information, visit alabamapublichealth.gov/IMM. Here's Andy Burcham with another Talking Tigers podcast.
Mike Lutzenkirchen's life changed on a Sunday morning in June of 2014. He and his family returned from Mass and learned that their son, Philip, had been killed in a traffic accident early that morning. The former Auburn tight end was dead at the age of 23. From this tragedy, the Lutzy 43 Foundation was formed. The foundation is used to inspire people to make better decisions behind the wheel. Mike continues to speak to groups of all ages across the country. Mike Lutzenkirchen and the Lutzy 43 Foundation are featured in this Talking Tigers podcast, brought to you by Alabama Public Health. Welcome in on another edition of the Talking Tigers podcast. Very glad to talk with Mike Lutzenkirchen with the Lutzy 43 Foundation. We have lots to talk about today. It's hard to believe it's been a decade now since this foundation began. We're going to talk about why. And so welcome, War Eagle.
Andy, War Eagle, it's always, in the past I've told you that first year after we lost Philip, couldn't come back down to Auburn, but ever since, the support we get with them, this community, both the university and just Auburn, Opelika in general, has given us great strength to drive this foundation.
What has the foundation become in 10 years?
You know, interesting, from a father to son relationship, it was very hard, quite frankly, to grow the foundation and have our 43 Key Seconds initiative to become kind of what the foundation's known for. It's that key with the 43 key seconds on it, and shifting from this really being Philip, the face of it, and Philip, the person, the story. And I struggled, quite frankly, up until about 18 months ago to accept that with as many people as trying to tell me that, Mike, you've become the face, the 43 keys, the face, but this is always about Philip and how it started. So we're doing some incredible things, both in the private sector, the government sector, anywhere from a 15-year-old permanent driver through 65 and older, what we're trying to do to save lives on the roads.
Where are you finding the 43 Foundation? Is it just the Southeast, or you expand it out?
We have tried to establish kind of a philosophy in the foundation, let's crawl before we walk, before we run. So, you know, early on, and I think in the first year and a half, we did over 200 talks, anywhere from the state of Washington down to Southern Cal through Texas, the Midwest, the Northeast, Maine of all places, Portland, Maine, Florida. But we're really trying to hit home and build something that can be repeatable out of the state of Georgia, being based in the Atlanta area. I mean, Alabama is certainly a focus for us, but it's Southeast with a big goal. You know, I've been telling everybody lately, I just turned 60, and God willing, health-wise and impact of what we think we're doing, I'm gonna do this till I'm 70 and sometimes start to worry about who's gonna take this over when my time is done, so that it endures, and we're proud that we're coming up on a 10-year anniversary.
Did you go from a career to a mission, so to speak?
Yeah, career, I was with IBM for many years. Used to lead sales teams and loved being customer-facing and trying to solve problems for companies that we had solutions for, but I guess I made the mistake. I look back and assisted three people leaving the company that weren't performing in sales in states that are pretty protective of employees, and got asked by HR to step into that type of role and stay in it. And I said, that's not who I am. I don't want to do that. So that was, I guess you could call my career. But the mission is definitely doing something to Philip's honor and trying to save lives on our roadways.
It's hard to, you mentioned when you sat down before we started. I guess it's been such a long time now since Philip's passing that some folks may not realize, other than maybe they see the highlight of the dance in 2010 at Alabama, they don't really know a lot about your son, Philip Lutzenkirchen. That's hard for me to understand, but that's the reality of it, isn't it?
I've been blessed to be chosen by Auburn, a group in the fraternity sector in a program called Auburn Man. It's a 6-week program every spring and fall semester. Mandatory attendance, 6 Mondays in a row at 6 p.m. to hear a guest speaker. And I have kind of become the de facto closeout speaker. I've done it now 4 or 5 semesters. I'm scheduled to do it here this spring. And this past fall, 900 new Greek students, after we showed the 4.5-minute intro video of who Philip is on and off the field, so that any audience gets a perspective of who he was and ultimately who I'm going to be talking about, I've learned to ask the question of, raise your hand if you knew who Philip was before that video. And estimated maybe 5% of the hands went up, and that's on the Auburn campus with Auburn students.
That's hard to believe for me. How do you react to that?
You know, it's interesting. I've thought this is kind of a weird thought all along. I've lost my son at age 23, so that's who I still visualize, which there's a lot of great things about that, Annie. But on the other hand, when you conversely think about it, had the path that happened not occurred, what would he be doing today? Hmm. Would he be married? What would he be doing for a living? You know, we're still at an age where our kids are at an age where some of their friends are still getting married, and you go to these weddings and you see a mother-son dance, and I always look over at Mary and just see there's a slight tear welling up in her eye because she never got a chance to do that. So those things are hard, but yeah, it's amazing how fast time has gone. You know, he passed away June 29th of 2014. People know him. He kind of put his name on the map. People say the Alabama, the Iron Bowl of 2010, when we fell behind, he ultimately had the game-winning touchdown. But I tell you, the game before that, or a couple games, yeah, games before that against Georgia, he had two TDs that game in a game that Auburn fell behind. So that's, to me, when he kind of really put himself on the map. And then he had a wonderful junior season. I think Sports Illustrated said he was a third-team All-American, conclusion of that. And then, unfortunately, a couple of significant injuries only gave him six games his senior year. So his season really ended probably about early October of 2012. So now you start thinking about that. It'll be 12 years going on that.
His name came back this year in one respect, that Rivaldo Fairweather had an opportunity to, well, he tied Phillips' record for most touchdowns by a tight end at Auburn and remained tied. He'll have another opportunity to break that record. That name, Philip Lessenkirk, had started to come back as we referred back to that year. When you think back to Philip, not as the football player, but as the son, what comes to your mind?
You know, he's one of four kids. He's got two older sisters, a younger sister. And I think our fans typically look at these kids that are so big and think they're adults right away just because of their size. He was a mama's boy. And he loved his mom, could just melt in her hands. Had a great relationship, unique relationship with each of his sisters. To me, his nickname was Boof. Boof, I don't even quite frankly remember how it all started.
Boof.
Boof. You know, I'd show up on sidelines at games here at Auburn. He'd like, the girls be like, so how quick do you think you'll get on the sideline this game without a pass? I said, I don't know. We'll see what can happen. And I'd be on that sideline. He'd come coming and run across doing that one stretch from sideline to sideline. He'd just look at me and goes, of course you made your way down here. And if he didn't see me, I'd yell, hey, Boof. So I knew he'd hear that. I've described that all these talks I've ever given. And my girls know I do this, that Phil was my best friend. Just, we had a wonderful respect of a father to a son to a father. We knew when we could goof around properly, when the son couldn't goof around with the father because I had to play that role. But very easy to be around, pretty easy going most of the time. Dedicated to what he loved to entertain people. And he had this uncanny ability to walk in a room, and if you didn't know you're not, you felt like he made you important.
I got to know Philip a little bit as someone that would talk to him, some almost on a weekly basis, just interviews. Weekly interviews on Media Day during the week or a post-game interview for the Auburn Sports Network. And there are some guys that it can be a tough interview. He was never a tough interview. He was always very cordial, yes, but had a lot of character, a lot of charm. And I enjoy it. I looked forward to talking with Philip. I knew if Philip was going to be on the post game, one, Auburn won the game, and two, we were going to have a good time talking about it with Philip. A lot of times he and I would talk food before the interview started because I knew that had grown up in the Chicago area, so I knew of his affinity for Portillo's, which I like as well. So he and I had one thing in common, and that kind of opened up the interview for us.
If it was food, I mean, he's probably talking coming from Chicago. I forget what the cost became when we'd go there, but he'd get two loaded hot dogs, Italian beef, a fry. When he got older, he'd say, Dad, how about a schooner of beer? But Gino's East, I mean, you name the deep dish pizza places. He loved to eat. In fact, his buddies in high school nicknamed him Landfill because he ate so much.
Look back to the 2010 season. He was such an important part of that national championship. What was that like for a father, for a family, to watch their son not only play, but play so well on a team that, an historic team at Auburn, to win a national championship out in the desert eventually?
Yeah, I mean, just an incredible run. I mean, that's his sophomore year. I remember him, you know, he wasn't even half joking when I had known who Cam Newton was. I saw Cam Newton played basketball his senior year at Westlake High School in Chicago, Atlanta area. Followed his career a little bit, and he came in here, and, you know, you're going into that January up until fall camp time of year, and Phillip's like, first of all, Dad, you hardly ever see the guy. He's either on his scooter going to class or watching film all the time. And Phillip goes, Dad, I think he realizes this may be his last chance. And I remember Phillip saying one day, he goes, I sure as hell hope he can play quarterback because he looks at like a tight end, and I'd be in trouble if he could maybe play tight end. And he just really didn't know how good Cam was going to be because he didn't touch him in practice. Then as the season started developing, Phillip had kind of found a niche role for himself. And if you remember that season, we were up at Kentucky, and that's a game. We went on a 15-play drive or more near the end of the game to win that thing. And Phillip got a stinger early in that second quarter and didn't play much that second half. But it's one of, I think, only two balls he didn't catch all year where he was targeted. And I remember after the game, he's like, yeah, I'm hurting like heck. They gave me a shot and everything. But it was after that game, I think, he got a lot of confidence going, and they started to go to him more and so forth. And I go back again. I mean, the two TDs against Georgia, that's the only game I didn't see him play in person because I was back in Chicago. My mom had a brain tumor removed 2 days beforehand, but I'm sitting up in Chicago on a Saturday and watching this game on CBS. And Phillip earlier today said that I may not play a lot today because of these stingers. And then he goes and has two touchdowns in that game that were pretty relevant. So he took us on a magical ride. I mean, it was just the whole recruiting experience, to some of the places he got recruited by, the people he was meeting, how he came down to make his decision to commit to Auburn and then stay through the changes and so forth. And Gene Chizik can correct me, but I think the last player Gene saw before the dead period going into Christmas that year was to come see Phillip, because there were rumors that he was going to flip, and he had never had any intention to flip. He did his homework to go look at a couple of our schools. But that magical ride started, I think, with that commitment there. And then 2010, I mean, how can you cap it? You know, to play a critical role, to be get named a captain the next year, have a really good junior year, to have a national championship ring, and then you get into his senior year. I think he was projected to be a third-round draft pick. Had he come out after that junior year, and he said, I had no intentions of that. Hey, I'm coming back. Coach said I'm going to be a captain again. Got a coaching change at that time, so he was excited about the pro terminology that was going to be used by Scott Leffler. And he literally thought they could win that national championship, and he could win the John Mackey Award. And then it kind of went downhill from there, but he still left here thinking, Dad, this is a magical place, and I'm forever going to love Auburn.
I hesitate to ask you this next part. You and I have talked about it before. The pros doesn't work out for Phillip. What was next for Phillip at that point?
Yeah, that's a great question, Andy. I don't know that I can answer that. Okay. He tried to make the Rams after coming off a pretty significant hip labrum surgery. He had a torn shoulder labrum surgery earlier in the year that year. And just said, Dad, I wasn't fast in the first place. Thought I was a pretty good athlete, but I couldn't regain any speed. And then he tried to make the Rams injured. And he couldn't get rehab because that sent the signal and so forth. And when he got cut that last game after preseason, he just says, I'm done. I don't need football. And I remember saying, why don't you come home and I'll take care of you. We'll bankroll you and you get healthy again, give another shot. He goes, don't need it. And he moved to Montgomery. He started a career in wealth management. We joked about it because he was a communications journalism major here at Auburn. I said, do you understand what you're getting yourself into with some of these Series 7 tests and things like that? He goes, don't worry about it. I'll do well at it. And he was living down in Montgomery with a dear friend he grew up with. Brian was in the media at that point down there. And Jimmy Perry heard that he was right down the road. Jimmy, you know, he's a former Auburn coach and off-the-field coach. He was at St. James at the time. And Phillip started to do some volunteer coaching and really loved it. He said, Dad, I think I'm meant to coach. And I made the decision, so go talk to Coach Melzon about it on staff. He goes, no, I don't want those hours. I don't want that level. I want to impact high school kids. So I believe he would have gotten to coaching, but that's just on really the last 30 days of his time on earth here, he started to get the taste for it.
Describe the day for you and the family.
Any parent's nightmare. You know, he's living in Montgomery. Our two older daughters had already graduated their respective colleges and were both living separately in Atlanta and had come home the night before that Saturday night to be with Mary and I. And I think we went to a charity event that night. Our youngest daughter, Abby, at the time, had finished her first year at Alabama playing soccer, and she had already had a couple surgeries, and she was down in Jacksonville, Florida, playing a semi-pro game. Part of a rehab, they gave her one opportunity to do that, and came home from Mass that morning, that sunny morning, a beautiful morning, June 29th, and as we pulled in a driveway, Mary saw something on the front door that turned out to be a post-it note. I pulled up short of the garage to let Mary to go out and get that out the front door. As I pulled in the garage, I vividly remember looking back at Amy and Ann and saying, where was Philip last night? And they gave me, as I look back, the strangest answer: we don't know. And for my kids not to know where each other was very odd. So they started texting around and so forth, and Mary met us inside the house and gave me that post-it note. All it said on it was, please call a number that began with a 706 area code. So, you know, right when you get that, you're like, this is not good. Dialed the first number, was told to dial another number, repeated the number out loud. Mary and the girls repeated it back to me. Dialed that number, and that time got a live voice that said, I'm the coroner of Troup County, and there was an accident last night, and Philip is dead. I mean, just plain and simple, that was the conversation. And as I look back over this, Andy, over the years, that gentleman did his job exactly like he was supposed to do it. But again, I watched Mary drop to her knees and our daughter Amy scream at the top of her lungs. Our daughter Ann's face turned brighter than the white on this wall, her face bright white. And all these talks I've given and times I've talked about this, it had to have been about 10 minutes before I realized Abby was on a bus. The only younger sister who looked up to her big brother, the hero, who's at Auburn, she's at Alabama, different sports, but that rivalry. And she was going to find out about this through social media. And called Abby, ultimately got to her coach, didn't know by name. And I just remember crying and saying, Coach, you need to watch out for my baby because her brother's dead. And Abby sat on that bus for 5 hours. To this day, I think there was one girl that loved her, knew her, but a bunch of other kids that weren't familiar with her. She was just a rehab, and that was a hard moment. That was a hard moment.
When did you grieve?
I think Andy just telling us I grieve a little bit, right? I was raised by a dad who was a full-time fireman, who had a father that had three boys. My grandfather was tough. You don't show tears. You don't show weakness. I think I really did a good job, I guess, as a man of not crying very often before losing my son. But there's things. I cried just the other day thinking of not having Philip for Christmas. So to a degree, I think I'm still grieving. People ask me, does this foundation and what our mission is, does that help the grief? I think it does. I think my faith is my faith in God, Jesus Christ and Holy Spirit is the reason we're doing what we're doing. I see God winks all the time. I think driving over here, I got gas at Bucky's, right? And it's 43 degrees driving over today. That's not... To some of the listeners or who's watching this, that's they may say that's a coincidence. I think that's God's plan for what I'm supposed to be doing, right, in Philip's honor. So I don't know. Grief, everybody handles it differently. I tell people all the time, there's no book on grief, but there's too many books on grief. You've got to grieve the way you think is going to help you cope. And that's, I mean, you've got your own experience with Rod, right? And what that did to you. And right. I've never tried to tell somebody how to grieve. I get, because of what we're doing, it's public of who Philip was. We get a lot of phone calls when there's a roadway killing or somebody died of cancer and it's a child and said, can you be available to that family? And I say that I am. But what I've learned on my walk, Andy, is I think I may have shared with you, I can't tell you how you're feeling. I can't tell another father who lost a 23-year-old son because that was the only father-son relationship. But I'll tell that father, I don't think you can tell your wife how to grieve either, because she was the only one who was the mother-son right. relationship. Grieve the way you think your heart's taking you. Now, I can tell you at 30,000 feet, the journey I've been on, I think there's probably going to be some similarities with a lot of people, and that's where I try to offer my availability to people.
War Eagle, it's a great day for Auburn Tigers to get vaccinated. Many children and adults that delayed vaccinations during the pandemic are still behind schedule. It's crucial that we take steps to get everyone back on track with their routine immunizations. Children and teens can still catch up on their vaccinations even if they start late. Make sure you and your family are all up to date on all recommended vaccines, including COVID-19 and flu. Let's all do our part to get back on track. Don't wait. Vaccinate. For more information, visit alabamapublichealth.gov/IMM.
When is the first time you've told this story?
You know, that's a great question. I can vividly remember getting a phone call from a gentleman by the name of Brent Buddy, head football coach at Woodstock High School over in Georgia. Really didn't know Brent that well, but he called me. Phil passed away June 29th of 14. He probably called me. I know when he called me. He called me the Saturday or Sunday of the opening week of high school football, where they had completed their 3 days of acclimation practice, which is no pads. He learned that his team had gone to a party. A lot of the kids on the team had gone to a party that weekend, and that a lot of kids were probably drinking. That was the first talk I delivered. After Philip passed away, the number of family and friends that just landed at the house, Jay Jacobs, I mean, flew in from Tampa. Freddie Gonzalez, the manager of the Braves at the time, would become a good friend. He came right to the house after a series against the Mets up in New York on that Sunday night, and didn't sleep that night, and went for a run the next morning at a place called Lita Thompson. It's a cinder track through the hills between Roswell and Marietta, where we live. Vividly remember having an argument with Philip that day at 6:30 in the morning when he said, "It's going to be okay." As if his big smiling face was right there. And I remember yelling out loud, "What do you mean it's going to be okay? I don't even know what the details are." I assumed there was alcohol involved with the age of these kids, but nothing had been said yet. And then there was God just looking at me, saying, "What are you going to do with this?" And there's a story we've told over the years of Philip met a young lady named Bailey Moody, whose mom played soccer here back in the day. Bailey was raised an Auburn fam, and she was ill. And Philip and I went and met with her, and she had cancer in her leg, had to have a leg amputated from above her right knee. She's now on the University of Alabama women's Paralympic wheelchair basketball team. So I think God's got a sense of humor in that. But that morning I went back to that Starbucks and just started scribbling words on those recycled brown napkins, words that describe Philip's character, wadded them up in a ball, brought them home, told Mary and the girls, "I'm not sure what we're going to do with this, but we've got to do something to honor Philip's life." And my immediate thought was, how could we help coaches who do a great job of getting their players bigger, faster, and stronger and run a great practice and can light up a scoreboard? But was there a way that we could use Philip's story and character and the things he did off the field to help them drive the faith of their students and the character of their student athletes?
Is that the start then of the Lutze 43 Foundation?
That really, I think in a nutshell, is when it started. And you know, you go through the 501c3 to get official nonprofit status and legal status of that. That took place in October. But talks had started. After I did that first talk, somehow, you know, Mark Richt in Georgia called, and Dabo and Clemson called, and a huge break for the foundation to get its legs was Tom Rinaldi and ESPN did a game day feature piece that fall of 14. And again, I believe God's got a sense of humor. In all of the places that could have aired that fall, it aired when game day was at Alabama. So that's kind of the background on how we got started.
What has that become, the Lutze 43 Foundation?
You know, we had a pivotal moment, Andy, in late 17, early 18. Somebody asked me two questions in the same conversation. Was I satisfied what we had accomplished that point with the foundation? And was I concerned about Philip's relevancy? And both great questions, both already on my heart a little bit. You know, at that time, 200-300 talks across the country. Pretty satisfied, but I come from an IBM background where when you're making your year-end number leading a team and 1231 rolls around, you feel real good until you see that new number for the next year. Knew we could be doing more, wanted to do more. The relevancy thing, I shared a little bit about Auburn already, and the kids here don't know who Philip is at this point. So it made us take a look at and said, you know, what do we have out there for all of us to look at, for all of us to view that's going to trigger us to be safer and smarter and more courteous drivers? And that's what led to the creation of 43 Key Seconds.
Yeah.
And what we did, Andy, is we put 43 on a key. Everybody knows what a key is. It goes on a lanyard. Some people much smarter than me said, "Mike, could we put our logo on the opposite side of the key? Could we put it on the lanyard? Could we put it on the checklist card and all that, the countdown card?" And we said, wow, that's a pretty neat idea. So what 43 Key Seconds is, it's no matter who you are, what your driving experience is, where you're driving, what you're driving, or what time of day, you ask yourself these key questions. Do I have a clear head, clear hands, clear eyes? And ultimately, we tie into the 20-year program of Click It or Ticket by saying, click it. And not to go through the whole thing, but what does a clear head mean? It means you ask yourself, am I drug impaired, alcohol impaired, fatigued, emotionally impaired, or technology impaired? And if you're any one of those, you have to have the common sense to step back and say, I'm not ready to drive. In our country, our leaders have invested in programs like Click It or Ticket. You text, you pay, drive sober, get pulled over. I think they're very relevant. I think in general, our government agencies, like in the state of Alabama, would be the Alabama Department of Transportation. It would be the Governor's Office of Highway Safety, which in Alabama really doesn't exist by title, but it's part of Alabama Law Enforcement Agency under Hal Taylor, ALEA, Public Safety. They, in my opinion, all individually do a very credible job of trying to eliminate and minimize the number of accidents, injuries, fatalities, and crashes. Yet our thing is, how do we not have an image? I went to a couple conferences and you know, heard some professionals say that of all of our senses, of what we taste and what we smell and what we touch and what we hear, it's what we see that triggers the most instant behavioral change. So we thought, wow, how about 43 key seconds with that countdown? You memorize the countdown. You then remove the card from the lanyard, and that lanyard and key go around your rearview mirror is that in-vehicle constant reminder that when you look at it, it's going to trigger you to put that phone down, to make sure everybody's wearing a seatbelt, to not be a super speeder, to really question, should you be out driving after midnight unless it's an emergency? And we're so thrilled at the government and private sector that are becoming aware of this. We're trying to create a new cause. And that cause is for the private sector to continue to invest in breast cancer awareness and Wounded Warrior Project, Alzheimer's research, where they've got a passion to do that. And I'll never ask anybody to walk away from those, but do you have room to add another one, which is helping us create safer roadways in partnership with our government agencies that are trying to do that?
Philip was 23 when he passed away. Is that the target audience when you're speaking, or does it matter the age?
Oh, I think initially, Andy, it was high school coaches and college teams and fraternities and church groups as fundraisers. But no, here's the reality, you know, in July 1st of 2018, the state of Georgia established a hands-free law. More than 3 years later, 4 years later, and I'm not sure that law even exists. It's hard to police. A lot of the cases get thrown out from what we've been told. So this is about adults that think it's okay, I can check that text, that email, and so forth. It's the teenagers that think they can still do whatever the popular social media of choice is right now. I think it's TikTok, that they can do that behind the wheel. Here's what we do see. When we go talk at a high school, and they'll invest in outfitting their students and faculty with that unit, with that high school logo on it. So, you know, Opelika Bulldogs, right? Those kids, that's who they are at this stage of their life. They're an Opelika High School student. Some are in athletics, some are in band, some are in drama. Some just go to school and don't do any extracurricular activities. But that's where they're at in their life. And the message when we go do a talk called Philip's Legacy, what legacy are you leaving? And I've never held punches about the things that took Philip's life, the poor decisions that were made, the lessons to learn from it. And what's great, it's all encompassing, right? I go back to drive sober, get pulled over addresses one topic. Click it or ticket, one topic. You text, you drive, one topic. This key is meant to be all encompassing. So that it gives a teenager that's driving that says, yeah, when we go to Georgia, you can't take your seatbelt off in the back seat, even though Georgia has a no seatbelt law in the back seat. Or up until recently in Alabama, I can hold my phone because it's not a law. In Alabama, it gives these kids courage to police one another. Lately, I'm on as big a kick when I'm at the high school audience in college that you as a passenger have as big a role to play as young drivers, inexperienced drivers, as that driver themselves. But don't get me wrong, if I'm in Birmingham on 280 and 459, the number of adults you see driving up those roadways holding their phone. So this is for everybody 15 and older with a permit to 65 and older. And we think we've really struck something. This key has a simplistic ability to transition a corporation watching out for their employees, watching out for their bottom line, so they have road safety protocols that are to be followed, especially by those employees driving a logoed vehicle. There's not as much emphasis by that corporation on those employees that drive their own vehicles. And there's very few companies that are taking what they've invested in roadway expectations and safety behind the wheel protocols and packaging it so you and I can take it home to our driving age family members. And we think we've identified this gap that we can help fill the behavioral change in that arena.
You talk candidly about that day and the decisions that were made. Is that tough to do?
No, it's not tough to do. It's Philip and I, again, I go back, best friend. We had a very straightforward, respectful relationship. And yeah, I do everything I can on earth to not judge people and to not sin. Like everybody else, I'm a sinner. I'm not sure I've earned my way into heaven yet, and that's a goal. I know that's where my son's at. And I want Philip, when I get there, to high-five me and say, Dad, job well done. You took a story that he didn't survive poor decisions. Many of us have survived poor decisions. I've survived poor decisions. And I just told an audience earlier today, I don't know why God took Philip at age 23. I've got some beliefs. One is this Auburn community allowed him to create a heck of a platform to become recognizable so people know who he is. So I think based on our faith, we're supposed to use that platform to make a difference for others. I go back again. He used to walk into a room and light up a room and make you feel important. I think he feels good about what we're doing to leverage his platform to make a difference for others. I think he's okay with me saying, yeah, they drank too much that day. They went out well after midnight for no other reason than the driver wanted to get a can of dip. Three of the four kids weren't wearing seatbelts. All three of those kids were partially ejected from the vehicle. The one young man that got in the front seat as a passenger that day and went to that right shoulder and came down on the left hip, that takes 2 seconds. He was drunk, but he walked away from the same vehicle with a concussion and ran for help. So the importance of wearing the seatbelt, the importance of getting through to these kids and any audience, that you shouldn't be on the road after midnight unless it's an emergency or a job requirement, that you shouldn't be a super speeder. They're going 77 miles in a 45 per the accident report. So there's all these lessons that came out about this that supports 43 key seconds, supports the comprehensive messaging and the countdown and the checklist. So to talk about the real things that took Philip's life, you know, one thing I tell every audience is I can't lie. The internet will prove me a liar. I can't BS anybody, right? So I just put the facts that are out there.
How is the Lutz and Kirkin family today?
Goofy, obnoxious, in love with one another. Have three grandchildren since we lost Philip. Have two son-in-laws since we lost Philip. Everybody's healthy, knock on wood. Still have a wife that loves me and lets me in the door, so I'm thrilled about marrying that. She hasn't wised up to realize what she's got herself involved with after 38 years of marriage and since dating, since sophomore year in high school. But, you know, I think I've talked to you in the past. All three of the girls dealt with this differently. Our oldest daughter, Amy, when the news came out of what Philip's BAC was, 6 weeks after he passed away, which was an astronomical number. She wanted to go and get everybody on the internet that had something wrong to say about her brother. The next daughter, Anne, she was so mad at Philip for letting him put himself in that position. And then Abby, the youngest, she questioned God. You know, where was God to watch this? So all three of the girls dealt with it differently. We have rotated the girls on and off the board every 2 years so they could be able to play a part of it. I'm thrilled that we were able to hire Abby 2 years ago after she got some very creditable a nonprofit experience with and for the Arthur Blank Family Foundation for almost 4 years. Abby's been on the foundation now since November. It's been 2 year anniversary this November that just passed. And she's doing some great things for the foundation. So we love coming back to Auburn. We're good.
How can folks learn more about the Lutz 43 Foundation?
We'd love you to go to Lutzie43.org, you know, www.lutzie43.org. We're revamping our website. Quite frankly, I'm getting burnt out about telling there's too much there. We can't get people, we can't get high school students to find where our scholarship program is, which, by the way, we've given out 94 scholarships at $4,300 a piece. We're very proud of. Mm-hmm. Over half of those recipients are Auburn students because of Philip's legacy and their family knowing who Philip was. We've given out 11 scholarships through the Auburn School of Communication and Journalism. in a semester-length program each semester. That's the Philip Lutzenkirchen Excellence in Public Speaking Awards. Please go learn about these scholarships. They're good at any two-year, four-year university. We've got Will Reichert, who just kicked a couple 50-yard-plus field goals in the semifinal game the other night. He's married to one of our scholarship winners that he met at Hoover High School, so we're proud of that. So even Alabama can go, right? So we're proud of that. But if you go to our website, you'll learn about what we're trying to do. If you're in corporate safety leadership or in a corporate leadership role, we think we can help your company be safer. We're confident that it can bleed over to your employees. And that's where this key starts to create a new cause of helping an organization, but getting you out in the community with a new focus on roadway safety. And that's our big initiative, Andy, that we think we can really accelerate our success in what we're doing and save a lot of lives.
It was a blessing for me to get to know Philip as an Auburn man, as an Auburn football player. It's been a blessing to get to know you since then. I appreciate your time. I appreciate your candid nature in talking about this. I appreciate the work that you're doing.
Well, Andy, I appreciate the friendship we've developed over the years, and we've both been able to rely on each other about some things we might not be experienced in that one might be can share with the other. So I'm grateful for that and ever grateful for this Auburn community. It's special. I would tell you, with a daughter who graduated from Georgia, one that played soccer and graduated from Winthrop University, and Abby who graduated from Alabama, all these university settings have these unique natural beauty to them. There is really something special about this Auburn community, and Philip absolutely loved it here. You go back again, what would he be like? I don't know, but I think there's high probability he could have been living in this community. He loved it so much. We're going to do all we can to continue to make this mission impactful, not only in the Southeast, but nationally.
War Eagle.
War Eagle.
For Mike Lutzenkirchen and the Talking Tigers podcast, brought to you by Alabama Public Health, I'm Andy Burcham. Be strong and be courageous. War Eagle.